The legislature adjourns. What was accomplished during this unusual session? The first special session of the 130th legislature was anything but usual. Legislators didn't meet in person until December, and then at first in a socially distant setting at the Augusta Civic Center. Once back at the State House, the January 6th insurrection led to stiff security measures. In March, Democrats angered Republicans by passing a baseline budget. There were historic and contentious issues, such as the plan to create a consumer-owned utility and allow gaming on tribal lands. And lawmakers passed precedent-setting bills on school nutrition and facial recognition technology. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, my colleague Steve Missler, Maine Public's chief government and politics reporter, joins us to recap the session. We'll also hear from legislative leaders. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The legislative session concluded yesterday, and we are going to discuss what was and wasn't accomplished. My guest today, my colleague Steve Missler, he is Maine Public's chief politics and government correspondent. We're also going to hear from legislative leaders from both parties throughout the hour. And as always, we invite your comments and questions. How closely did you follow this session? Were there certain bills you are especially interested in? What issues matter most to you moving forward? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call. And our number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Steve, congratulations, you made it. This was an unusual session, wasn't it? I mean, in so many ways, it's hard to believe that when we were talking about possibly meeting at the Civic Center was indeed this session.
I know, it feels like a million years ago. And, you know, and I was thinking about that, Jen, last night when I was driving home from the Capitol, which was, you know, on the last day of the session, which fortunately ended when there was a little bit of light in the sky, which is unusual. But, you know, it's just been a long, strange trip, and it's only been a few months. But, you know, it's been strange, obviously, because of the pandemic, but also just the national political atmosphere. It really had, you know, it tended to trickle down here in the Maine legislature, which doesn't always happen, but it certainly did this year. You know, it began in the midst of this raging dispute about the presidential election. While that was obviously national issue, it came down here. You know, we had Republican lawmakers who were urging the Maine Attorney General to join the Texas lawsuit that sought to throw out the results of key swing states. And then January 6th happened at the U.S. Capitol, and that, of course, led to big security crackdowns at the state houses across the country, including here, over fears that something, you know, might happen in those seats of power. You know, we actually had tactical teams just down the hallway, you know, staging just in case there was some attempt to breach the building or the state house itself, which, of course, was closed because of the pandemic to the public. And, you know, there were fights over masking policy. And, you know, the session, you know, began almost entirely remotely. I mean, public hearings were broadcast on YouTube. That's entirely new. Same with work sessions and press conferences. And, you know, while that was necessary because of the pandemic, arguably, I think it may have, maybe contributed to tensions here. You know, the legislature is a place of partisan conflicts, of course, but it's also a place of relationships. And yet you had this inherent deficiency of trust between the two major political parties and no real opportunity for them to try to, you know, to iron out those differences face to face, which is usually what happens. And that really set the stage for a pretty tumultuous session. And you saw that even last night.
Well, and let's talk about that. The last major bit of business was this allocation of federal rescue plan funds. The governor last week said she was really hoping for some sort of bipartisan agreement so that the funding could go into effect right away. She did not get that. Explain what the issues were in the end and what the impact is of passing this spending plan the way they did.
Yeah, I'll start with the second part of your question, Jen. By passing the spending bill without a supermajority, which is what the governor was advocating for last week, means that the law, this $1 billion spending package, won't go into effect until October, which of course delays the spending of the funds that were included in that initiative, which are substantial. And they, you know, they affect small businesses, workers, you name it. You know, and I think the governor was hoping to avoid that outcome. But I think Democrats who have the majorities here seemed confident that it won't have an adverse effect on the recovery and investment plan, which is what that bill was designed to bolster. But the issues, to get to your first part of your question, were really relatively few. And it really wasn't about money, which is also very unusual. I think the two sides agreed on 97% of what was ultimately passed. But Republicans wanted more money into the unemployment trust fund, which to offset possible rate increases for businesses that may have laid off workers during the pandemic. Their other objection centered on about $20 million, if I recall correctly, in affordable housing projects. But again, they didn't object to the spending on affordable housing. What they objected to were these agreements, which are called project labor agreements, or PLAs, which essentially require union labor for specific projects. Democrats wanted to set aside $20 million for PLA projects, and Republicans just objected to that.
And it's not crossing the line on the sand and over parts of the bill that were really not major parts. That kind of is an indication of what you were talking about at the beginning, the partisan nature of this year's session.
Yeah. And I think, you know, going back, I mean, you think about back in March, Democrats flexed their majorities then and basically passing a baseline budget. And that also, I believe, I think you can argue it was based out of a deficiency of trust. I think Democrats, there was a previous fight over a supplemental budget bill where Republicans were really holding firm on certain tax initiatives, some of them which were very obscure. And Democrats saw that as a potential foreshadowing of a budget fight that could have led to a government shutdown. And they just didn't want to deal with that. So that was their public justification for doing what they did. But when they did that, they really took away the Republicans' bargaining power for any subsequent spending measures, including the one that passed last night. And of course, Republicans were really upset about that because they wanted to be a part of those negotiations and at least be able to, you know, have some kind of leverage therein. And they lost that effectively back in March.
In the end, we saw Governor Mills veto quite a few bills. I think the number was 31. Not nearly as many as Governor LePage, of course. And I want to talk more specifically about a couple of the bills that she did veto in just a minute. But I'm wondering generally, what do these vetoes signal about the governor and the governor's relationship with the legislature?
Well, I think you need to remember about Governor Mills is that, you know, she is a centrist Democrat, always has been, served in the legislature. And at a time when I think more of her kind, if you will, were also serving in the legislature. So she, I think, views a lot of some of these policy initiatives that she ultimately rejected as maybe being too far left. Now, she also had legal rationales for rejecting a lot of these bills. So I think it falls along two lines, Jen. You know, one is maybe just more in line with her political ethos. And then the other one is that, you know, she's also a lawyer and she would come up with legal rationale for rejecting some of these. So I think it's a little bit political and a little bit legal. And the governor obviously, you know, put her stamp on, I think it was more closer to 25 bills, not to correct you, but
it's just
way less than what Governor LePage had done, but there's really no comparing between the two governors, to be honest. You know, and I think, you know, obviously that made some Democrats very unhappy, and certainly the progressive activists that were pushing those bills, which included in some instances environmentalists, criminal justice reformers. And I think, you know, those folks are unhappy. They just didn't feel like the governor had their back on a couple of bills. I mean, the governor would disagree with that assessment, but that's the way they feel. And, you know, the thinking among some of these folks is that there's concern that as the governor goes into re-election next year in a midterm election, when, you know, you really need your base to turn out, that there's some concern among some Democrats, not all, that, you know, this will dampen enthusiasm for her reelection bid when she faces Governor Paula Page, who's trying to make a comeback.
Let's talk briefly about a couple of those controversial vetoes. The plan for creating Pine Tree Power, a consumer-owned utility that would replace CMP and Versant. The group behind it, Our Power, sent out a tweet after her veto calling it political cowardice. Harsh. Was that accurate?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, that's certainly a view shared by advocates of the consumer-owned utility, which is what Our Power is advocating for. Essentially, what they wanted and what the bill would have done was to buy out Maine's two dominant electric companies, Versant Power and Central Maine Power, and replace them with a consumer-owned utility that's effectively run by an elected board. You know, the governor had an array of concerns that about this proposal, one of which is that she didn't believe it was fully vetted, also thought that it was pandering too much to some of the anti-CMP sentiment that's out there. You know, and I think, you know, what the problem, I think, for some of the folks who thought that was political cowardice is that there were quite a few lawmakers who ended up agreeing with the governor. I mean, yes, the bill made it to her desk, but by majority votes. However, there had to be some last minute adjustments to that bill to even get it there. And then yesterday, when her veto came up for a vote, and they given the chance to override, it didn't even get out of the House. You know, it was nowhere near the 2/3 majority it would have needed to override the governor's veto. So, you know, if Governor Mills, I think, you know, would arguably say that she's got a lot of people in both parties, by the way, that agree with her on this particular issue, that it may have just been too much too soon. And she did leave open the door to a possible takeover down the road of these utilities if they can't get their act together. But, you know, I think advocates of the bill were really disappointed. They wanted to see something now, and they may get it, but it might not be for until 2022. Because advocates are trying to get this on the same bill as a referendum next year.
The bill that would allow tribal nations gaming rights is another one that she vetoed. What do you read into this veto, and how does it fit into the bigger conversation about tribal sovereignty?
Well, this is an issue that comes up almost every session, Jen. There's always a push to try to give the tribes gaming rights, or, you know, allow them to construct a facility on their lands, and yet it comes down to a disagreement over whether they're allowed to do that because of the Land Claim Settlement Act, or just generally whether or not it's best for the Maine economy, which already has gambling operations in two parts of the state, when you're talking about casinos anyway, and, you know, whether or not the state could sustain a third. I mean, those are the issues that have been out there for years. But in a political context, it's harmful to Mills in the sense that she, as attorney general, she was often in legal disputes with the tribes, and the tribes did not see her as a friendly, you know, person when she was elected governor. She had to do a lot of outreach to try to get, you know, to try to appease them in some ways. And I don't think that has resolved itself. And so the tribal gaming rights is just an extension of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the larger problem that she faces politically speaking. And, you know, I think the tribes would like to resolve it, though.
And I should note that last week, Attorney General Fry was on Maine Calling, and he said that all sides are committed to working over the summer on perhaps a new gaming bill. So we'll see something else next year. I do want to talk about some of the precedent-setting bills that did pass the legislature, specifically universal school lunch and facial recognition. But before that, I'm going to go to Senate President Troy Jackson calling in. Senate President Jackson, welcome back to Maine Calling. Are you calling from Augusta or Allegash?
No, I'm in Augusta still from a long day yesterday.
Well, let me just ask you, as you look back on this unusual session, what do you believe is most, what was the most important aspect of it? What do you carry with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, definitely, I think next year is my 18th year, and It definitely was a completely different session. A lot of highs and lows, but I mean, I think there's an awful lot of stuff that we did this session. But when I, you know, look back on probably the things that I'll be, you know, the proudest about is the free school lunches for children. You know, I mean, this pandemic, I mean, we knew before that, you know, we had a real problem with food insecurity in across Maine, you know, way before. And I don't think it really came to play to understand as much as I did anyways, until this pandemic with, you know, going across my district and, you know, coolers out to mailboxes alongside the road throughout my district. And I didn't know what that was at first, but, you know, it was the school still delivering meals to homes that needed them throughout the pandemic. And that really cemented to me what a big issue it is for kids going to school that, you know, are hungry. You know, in my district, you know, they get picked up at 6 o'clock in the morning. They get back at 4:30 at night. I mean, there's no person that I know of in the world that goes to a setting and sits 10 and a half hours a day and doesn't eat. And we literally had kids that were doing that either for stigma or, you know, the fact they didn't have the money or whatever. And so, I'll always be extremely proud that we did that one. You know, property tax relief for, you know, people across this state, you know, getting to 55% for education, 5% for revenue sharing. Last night we did Senator Bailey's bill for seniors, you know, to be able to stay in their homes. Those things are hugely important. And I mean, we did a lot for trying to help businesses and workers throughout the state. There's a lot, you know, but I'd be remiss to say I think a lot about the things that we didn't do and failing on those prescription drug bills. I heard you talk about political cowardice a while ago. Well, that's certainly one that I'll remember.
Senator Jackson, I so appreciate you calling in and sharing this with us. And going back to the bill about school lunches, I'm happy you brought that up. I wanted to talk about that. It is, from what I understand, a first in the nation bill. And Senator Jackson, this had bipartisan support, correct?
Yeah, it actually turned out extremely well. And I mean, that's, you know, how in my mind the legislature should work. I mean, an issue that was important for all of us, and, you know, we didn't get caught up in the politics. We just went forward and did the right thing. And, you know, it's kind of shocking that it took us that long as the legislature to actually do that. But, you know, everything just came together. I mean, I think the pandemic kind of helped cement the problem in a lot of people's heads, certainly mine. And we got it done. And like I said, I think it's, you know, I there's been a little bit of flack from people outside about it, just a little bit. But I think, you know, years to come, we'll look back on this and wonder why we didn't do it sooner. That it's just going to be a tremendous benefit to, you know, children, families, and educational opportunities across the state.
Steve.
Well, Senator President Jackson, I just wanted to, I was, that image you brought up about the lunches being outside of mailboxes, for me, it just reinforces like a theme from the pandemic. And we would see that during the course of the session too, where issues that were maybe felt a lot very abstract became suddenly very real and visible. And it sounds like this, you know, this free school lunches one was a good example of that. Can you think of any others?
Well, I think, like I said, overall, you know, healthcare, you know, early on, like I said, there was so much that we did, but LD1 for the free testing and getting the COVID shot, I mean, I think it brought, again, the problem of healthcare in this country. And that's why I say I'm so disappointed in the, you know, the bills on prescription drugs that we didn't get, you know, through. I mean, people were having a hard time being able to get tested as far as, you know, having to pay for it. A lot of people were out of work at that time. And when we made that, you know, free for people to get tested so they wouldn't, you know, have that as a barrier. I mean, I heard from a lot of people across the state on, you know, how important it was. And that just reinforced the problem that we have with healthcare in this country and not, you know, federal government's not doing their job. And states have to take more of that on. And you know, we did some things. We did some stuff with insulin, which was really great. We did, you know, yesterday we got the funding for the affordability board but we dropped the ball on prescription drug coverage and making meaningful change on that. And so that's why I say definitely a lot of highs I'm proud of, but unfortunately, I'm the type of guy that thinks about the losses as much, if not more.
Senate President Troy Jackson, thank you so much for calling in to Maine Calling today. I hope you have a safe and scenic drive home. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about this year's legislative session and hear from more legislative leaders. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Local Living School, nurturing the human-earth relationship through outdoor learning, offering a family sustainability stay, and the Living in Maine semester. And the Bates College Museum of Art, featuring Maine landscapes in the collection exhibition Carl Benton Straub, His Enduring Legacy. Not only is Maine Public Television available free over the air, it's also streaming live at mainepublic.org. You can enjoy all of your favorite PBS and Maine Public Television programs and even discover new favorites throughout the day. Check it out at mainepublic.org/live TV. If you're without internet, you can still access Maine Public's 4 television stations over the air with an HDTV antenna. To learn more about Maine Public Television over the air and for helpful information on choosing your antenna, please visit mainepublic.org. Free access to Maine Public Television is made possible through the generous support of our members. Consider becoming a member today to help us deliver this great service to our neighbors throughout Maine. Thank you.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, our topic is a recap of this most unusual legislative session. My guest is Steve Missler, who is Maine Public's Chief Politics and Government Correspondent. Share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Representative Kathleen Dillingham, who is the minority leader, the Republican, in the Maine House of Representatives. Representative Dillingham, thanks so much for calling in.
Oh, thank you very much for having me this morning.
I'll ask you the same question I asked Troy Jackson, which is, what was most important to you this session? What will you take away?
I think I would have to follow suit with him that there was so much. It seemed like it was going to be the session that never ended. And I've been in Augusta, I think, 20 years, and what we've gone through, something that none of us have ever had to deal with before, and trying to figure out not only within our caucuses and how to manage, sharing information and making sure everyone is informed, but certainly as legislative counsel, trying to figure out how we're going to manage session and making sure the public is informed. So this certainly was, learning by fire and a challenge. I think that we had some, bumps along the way, maybe some disagreements on how maybe things should be done, but we eventually got it done. Very pleased with that. Pleased that we were able to come together on a change package, the supplemental that received strong bipartisan support. Disappointed we were unable to do that with the ARPA funds. Some great pieces of legislation. I think it's important that, for the public to know, Maine people to know, when it comes to health and safety and education of Maine citizens, that it's not a partisan issue. And we were able to come to agreement on a lot of places around different initiatives dealing with education, with property tax relief, making sure that we support our municipalities. And personally, for me, being able to have a piece of legislation passed that is looking at mental health for a small portion of our first responders and law enforcement family, very pleased to get the support I did on that piece of legislation.
It sure is a lot. Steve Missler, do you have a question for Representative Dillingham?
Yeah, I do. Representative, I'm just curious, because it's fresh in our minds about what happened yesterday with the ARPA funds or the rescue plan funds, and the fact that we couldn't get to a 2/3. I know what Republicans were hoping for. I'm curious, are you worried about the delay in dispensing of those funds? Is that something that's top of mind for you?
I'm not necessarily It's not a worry. It's a disappointment. In speaking with certainly school administrations, they are aware the funds are coming. They'll be able to manage certainly the different businesses' ability for different grant funding, all of those pieces that are in the ARP package. The individuals know the grants and or this funding is going to be coming, and they've expressed to me that, again, disappointment that it wouldn't be immediate, but knowing that it is coming, it is secure, that they're able to function and work around that. So I think the disappointment is, again, that I don't feel that there was any true negotiations on the ARP funds. It was, my members on appropriations and my lead on appropriations went in thinking we were going to be looking at the proposal from the governor, handed, I think a four-page document that had 30-plus initiatives on it, many of which came off the table. We had discussions. Bills weren't going to be coming off the table other than what we dealt with in the change package. So sat down, had to take a look at that very short time frame that they would be voting on it, and then told, go into that day of voting, and I believe there was another 10 new initiatives. So it didn't lead. It wasn't a conducive way to try to negotiate, and certainly anyone who has worked with my lead on appropriations, Representative Solomon Millett, he is certainly an individual that strives to reach agreement, consensus where that can be reached, negotiates in very good faith, and at the end of the day felt that there wasn't going to be a way to come to agreement, and certainly not within the time frame that was presented. And my members on appropriations offered their own minority report. And then yesterday on the House floor, I offered an amendment to the majority report that would more accurately reflect what our minority report tried to represent, tried to find an agreement, and that was dispensed with an indefinite postponement. So unfortunate that we couldn't get to 2/3, but happy that there's other places that we were able to reach agreement throughout the session on other important parts of pieces of legislation for Maine people.
Well, Representative Kathleen Dillingham, Minority Leader, Republican from Oxford, Maine House of Representatives, thank you so much for calling in. I hope you have a terrific rest of the summer. It seems as though
you too.
Skies have cleared for you a little bit today. Thank
I've
you.
I've got some farming to do, so that's great.
Thank you. And we're going to move on now. We have the Speaker of the House, Ryan Fecteau, calling in. Speaker Fecteau, thanks so much for joining us on Maine Calling.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer. Good to be here.
So what stands out for you the most? What are you most proud of this session?
Well, I think the common theme would be it's, difficult to choose just one thing. But I have to say, I think this has been the most transformational legislative session in many decades. And what I mean by that is if you look at the work that we have accomplished over the last 6 months, a few members have already noted, the president of the Senate and Representative Dillingham noted the challenges we faced in just getting the work done to begin with. conducting our legislative business in a way that we have never done so before. But when you look at the work that we were able to accomplish, for example, when I first got elected 7 years ago to the legislature, one of my primary goals was getting our career and technical education centers funded, otherwise known as vocational schools. They had not received a statewide investment since 1998, which was $5 million back then. We were able to invest $40 million both in the change package and the American Rescue Plan bill for upgrades to the buildings themselves and to equipment that the students are using. That's not only going to make sure that the education that those students are receiving is top notch, it's going to prepare them for the workforce so that businesses that are in need of workers will be able to employ these students when they graduate, whether that's directly after high school or after they go on to college or community college. Another huge victory for, I think, this legislature was expanding dental coverage to adults across the state. Nearly 200,000 people here in our state who are not eligible for dental care unless it was an emergency, unless their gums and teeth and mouth were in so much pain that they had to go to the ER. That was the only way they could get covered. We expanded dental coverage to over 200,000 Mainers. A couple other items were already mentioned, 55% for education, voters approved that referendum 17 years ago. We had failed to meet that that moment time and time again. Finally, we are funding education at 55%, revenue sharing back at 5%, several provisions related to property tax relief. I think you'd probably need a two-hour show to really to go through all of the items that we were able to accomplish. But I truly believe this legislative session, despite the challenges and obviously the obstacles that Mainers face across the state as we come out of this this pandemic, which also had an economic impact to a huge degree, I believe this was the most transformational legislative session in many decades.
All right. When you talk about the 2 hours we would need or more, Steve is nodding. Steve Missler.
Yeah, you could do 2 hours on the bill you guys passed yesterday.
Yes.
Just all the provisions in there. It's an 80-page bill. I get, Mr. Speaker, I'm wondering just, you know, obviously a lot of this, a lot of these initiatives were funded with federal money, and some, and in, you know, in most cases, that's one-time money. Do you worry about the sustainability of some of these? And I don't have any top of mind to raise as an example, but are you worried that, or maybe, well, I guess the 55% for education, local education costs is a good example. Do you worry about how sustainable it is to maintain that level of funding in the out years beyond the budget that you guys were able to enact?
Right. I mean, as far as the American Rescue Plan dollars are concerned, we were very thoughtful about using those funds for programs that really were one-time funding, or they were creating pilots. So, I mean, a good example of utilization of those dollars for a one-time project, $150 million dedicated to broadband expansion. Obviously, expanding broadband, those one-time dollars will have a huge impact on bringing access to broadband to Mainers across the state, particularly in underserved areas, rural parts of the state. So I thought that was a really great use of American Rescue Plan dollars. There's also $20 million in the of funds that we're using for sea level rise, addressing sea level rise, making sure infrastructure is in place to prepare communities, especially along the coast, for sea level rise. You know, when you think about education funding, that was built into the baseline of the state budget. So that is something that we will hopefully continue to meet. Obviously, two-year budgets are always challenging because they're dependent on revenues, and as revenues go down and or up, there's a shift in tide. But it's my hope that we will continue to meet our commitment to 55% for education. You know, things are looking good. I think right now in the economy, it seems like the tourism season is certainly underway. And for anyone who's been on the roads, we see many folks from out of state. And I've been hearing from folks in the hospitality industry, although they're facing challenges with the workforce, it seems like we are having a really robust summer season, which should be a good sign for the Maine economy, which also means the Maine budget will hopefully be continue to be in really good shape moving forward, which will allow us to continue these critical investments.
Well, Speaker of the House, Ryan Fecteau, thanks so much for calling in, and get some rest. Thanks for calling
Thank
into Maine
you.
Calling
yeah.
today.
I'm looking forward to it.
and Steve, you know, we've been talking about a lot of the bills that got passed, but one we really haven't talked about yet is what's being called the most stringent facial recognition ban in the country. Tell us exactly what it does and doesn't do. Who does this? Is this only apply to law enforcement, or is it broader than that?
Well, it's a little bit broader than that, Jen. It basically prohibits the use of facial recognition, which is a developing technology, and it's been in the news quite a bit, but it prohibits the use of surveillance through facial recognition technologies by government actors, except in limited cases, such as, you know, the most serious crimes, you know, investigations into murder or rape or other violent crimes. You know, the new law also basically specifies that law enforcement in rare cases are allowed to use that software, but must use public databases in an attempt to standardize the quality of the photos and increase accountability when errors are made. So it is a sweeping bill. I think some folks would like to see a tighter crackdown on this, but, you know, because Maine is the first to enact such a measure, it's getting a lot of attention because it is a landmark bill in that regard. But, you know, there is a local example of this that's been in place in Portland the city of Portland for a little while. So, you know, we've got a little bit of a pilot project there that we can look to see how it's working.
All right. Well, we do need to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll have Senate Republican leader Jeffrey Timberlake on the show. This is Maine Calling, and we are talking about the legislative session. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Cumberland Crossing, a new retirement community offering access to Ocean View at Falmouth's Care Continuum. CumberlandCrossingRC.com. By Valo, guiding teens toward emotional well-being to connect with community and ignite a future with hope. ValoMaine.org. And Theater Monmouth with Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, a dark comedy about the true nature of love and mercy. TheaterMonmouth.org.
I'm Robin Young. Survivors of Canada's boarding schools for forced assimilation of Indigenous kids testify about the horrors children saw in the church-run schools.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter froze to death.
We'll speak with the chief of Canada's 634 First Nations next time, Here and Now.
Stay tuned. Here and Now is coming up after Maine Calling from 12 noon until 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we are talking about the just concluded legislative session. My guest, Maine Public's very own Steve Missler, who is our chief politics and government correspondent. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, if you're quick, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post on Facebook or Instagram. And joining us now, Senator Jeffrey Timberlake, who is minority leader at the Maine State Senate. Senator Timberlake, thanks so much for calling back to Maine Calling. And I'm wondering, I'll ask you the same thing I asked the others. What is your biggest takeaway? What are you most proud of and maybe disappointed by after the session?
Wow. Two trick questions right off quick, huh?
Not intended to be.
No, they're not. I think my takeaway is that I think this was a very challenging session. I'm not necessarily proud of how this session went down and how it happened. I don't think that the Maine people got the best bang for their buck. We carried over, you know, hundreds of bills that shouldn't normally happen if the committees would have done their job. But I thought of it, you know, you can blame some of it on the pandemic, but it's not all the pandemic. It's been a very challenging session. It's been more partisan. You know, this is my 12th, 13th year at it, and it's probably been the most partisan session that I can remember. And I think the things that we're proud of, we did get LD 221 passed, which we did that in a bipartisan two-thirds way, which was the out of the three budgets that we passed, it's the only one that got two-thirds vote. Everything else was just the majority party voting it out. So that depresses me. But we did get LD 221 passed, which had some things in it, which gave, you know, which was one of the Republicans' priority was we was hoping to get $300 million to get back to the people, but we did get $150 million to get back to the working people of the state of Maine. Who,
Senator, I don't know my bill numbers. Is that the property tax relief?
LD 221 was the last supplemental budget we did out June 19th. LD 221 was the big supplemental budget that we passed with two-thirds vote back about June. And that's the $300. We was hoping to give $300 back to everybody that worked during the pandemic, but we only got $150 a person back during that. We got $150 million going back to the taxpayers of the state of Maine.
Steve.
Yeah, Senator Timberlake, I guess it just you're talking about the basically what was called the change package to the baseline budget. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was after the majority budget was passed back on, I think, March 30th, where it wasn't a complete budget. They didn't have it done right, and they had to come back and do a supplemental to fix it.
Yeah, I guess I have a just to follow up real quick. I know you and I've heard you mention this before in various legislative council meetings. that it was the pandemic and, you know, the way everything was done remotely made it really hard for people to kind of build relationships, which is generally what happens here. Is that what you mean? Is that maybe you felt like they were too slow coming back to work in person?
Yeah, I think, and they made it difficult. Steve, you've been around there a long time, and so has Jennifer. Both of us have been there for a long time. But I'll use an example of my own sister, Representative Lyman. She's a freshman legislator this year. And we was in May, and she still didn't know everybody in her Republican caucus because you hadn't been around. We hadn't been together. We hadn't, you know, you meet them going over to the Civic Center for a short period of time, but you didn't make any relationships. You know, I say one of the interesting stories around there is, Steve, you remember Andy O'Brien. Andy O'Brien and I are about as far apart left to right as any two people can be, but yet we're really good friends. And we created a relationship because we served on the Ag Committee together and we sat beside each other. And those relationships spawned bipartisanship on bills that when you're sitting around the table together, you can come up with an idea and I could say to you or you could say to me, hey, Jeff, you know, I know you don't like this, but you like this. Can we talk about it? And we'd have the Connor caucuses, which you would report as hated because we'd go off in our corners and we'd
tell a secret story about.
Well, that's what you used to call it. We used to try to call it breaking the ice to get through. And we'd go into the Connor caucus and say, okay, I can agree with this. And then the chairs would get together and talk for a minute and say, okay, well, if Timberlake can agree to this and Missler can agree to this, then let's just bring this proposal forward. That didn't happen because we sat, you know, miles apart from each other, looking through a computer screen. Everybody was a keyboard warrior. And there's something about when you and I have this conversation over the phone like we're having now, or if we're sitting face-to-face, it's that relationship and that courage to say things that you wouldn't normally say if you was looking me square in the eye. And that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think people that you could see that too, for sure. You could definitely see it. And I don't know. I mean, I'd be curious on your take. I don't want to take too much time, but whether or not you feel like that separation had anything to do with how the budget went down, the baseline budget in particular.
I do. I think there was no faith. I think because we hadn't had any face to face, we hadn't done all those things. I think some people felt that the Republicans were not going to want to sit at the table and have that discussion. And I tried to make it very clear, whether it was you I talked to or anybody I talked to, my phone line was open. I'm willing to sit to the table and talk. I was willing to sit to the table and talk all this last weekend over the APRA money. But, you know, we wanted to be part of the conversation. And in order to have a seat at the table, you got to keep your phone line open and your options open, and we wanted that. And I think because of the way we were set up with these Zoom meetings, it didn't happen, and nobody put any faith in anybody. Nobody
Senator,
trusted anybody.
I really appreciate you calling into today's program, and before I have to let you go, I have to ask you how the apple season is so far this summer, the strange weather, first drought and then rain.
This rain has been a blessing. The apple crop is looking fantastic now. I was really concerned 2 weeks ago. Apples are growing good. The trees, I'm setting right up in the middle of my orchard right now as I talk to you. And it's just, you know, I'm looking forward to fall and looking, I'm working out in the orchard today. So, you know, we're going to move forward and we'll get through this.
Thank you so much for calling in, Senator Jeff Timberlake, the minority leader of the Maine State Senate. We're going to go to Saco, where Jay is calling from. Hi, Jay. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, when we elected the legislature of the state of Maine, we chose them to be our leaders to help us through good times and bad. And when we faced the worst foe that we have in this state's 200-year history in COVID-19, they abandoned us. They fled for the hills. They left us to our own devices. They didn't come to work for a year. They still took a paycheck, which is disgusting on a whole other level. They bring such shame to us. I'm totally blown away to sit here and listen to your self-congratulation when we had to sit and watch on national news that we were the only legislature of all 50 states to flee in fear and leave their constituencies
sure.
to the wolves.
Jay, Steve, Jay's making a point that Jay's making a point that many others were making, especially a few months ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think we heard this complaint with some frequency just because the lawmakers were not here in person. Of course, the reason for that was that we didn't have vaccine at the time. And, you know, there was some concern about whether, you know, people getting sick. And, you know, one of the things, you know, you mentioned that the legislators are elected to represent Maine's population, which is true. And a lot of the legislators here are a little bit older and higher risk too. So I think there was some concern about not only protecting them, but also protecting the employees that work here, and which is one of the reasons why, you know, the legislative leaders decided to do most of the session remote. Now, the remote aspect of the session also, I think, and some members of the public have expressed this to me, also opened up doors, because what happens, and because all the public hearings were broadcast over YouTube, and you could participate over YouTube. So what normally happens in public hearings, if there's a bill, people would have to trek all the way here to Augusta to attend and testify if they wanted to do that. In this case, they could actually sit at home and dial into a Zoom meeting or a committee hearing on any particular bill, anything that passed the session, anything that didn't. And they could actually testify and read their thoughts over a Zoom meeting and have them heard in a public hearing, which, you know, so you could argue that it increased access and public participation. Obviously, the issues that Senator Timberlake mentioned were also a problem, too, just in terms of personal relationships between the legislators themselves. That was definitely an issue.
We've covered several of the major bills in this legislative session. But one we haven't talked about yet, Steve, is the recycling bill that passed pretty late in the session. Why is this one a landmark bill?
Well, it's a landmark bill, and because it's called extended producer responsibility. And at the end of the day, what it ultimately does is it charges producers of packaging material for dispensing with them. You know, as we know, and it's been covered quite a bit in recent years, is that the recycling market in Maine and all across the country has cratered because China is no longer taking our recycling materials. And so we have these big, huge recycling programs in municipalities across the state that are struggling to pay for themselves because the market has dried up. And so what this EPR bill does is essentially put that cost back on the people who make the packaging, you know, the people who put, you know, a wedge of watermelon in a plastic container that's, you know, three times the size of the wedge, and they would be charged for basically manufacturing that. So the way advocates saw it, and municipalities really supported it too, was that a way of saving recycling, because right now, if you look at any municipal budget, recycling is not paying for itself right now. And people like to recycle. It makes them feel good. It makes them feel like they're not wasting things. And they would like to, they like the idea of it being, you know, things that they use being reused in some fashion. And so I think a lot of folks not basically see this as saving taxpayers money and being helpful to the environment.
We have an email here from Mo. LD920 was a bill that protected Maine municipalities from essentially unregulated video service providers by establishing the PUC as a regulatory body. It had strong support, was nevertheless vetoed. I'd like to hear thoughts on this bill. And Steve, I ask this question hesitantly because I know there is absolutely no way that one human, no matter how smart, can keep track of all the bills. But this was one that Governor Mills vetoed.
Yeah, and this is, unfortunately, he got me on, the writer got me on one that I don't know very well, and I won't speak too much about it, except that, I probably shouldn't say anything, honestly.
So, okay, well, let me ask you this.
I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, we just have a few minutes left, Steve. And I know that you and the other reporters up at the State House, especially in a session that's coming at such a rapid fire pace as this one did, are doing your best to keep up with everything developing in many chambers all at once, many legislative hearings. For the people who don't know, in Steve's office, in Mal Leary's former office, you're able to monitor multiple hearings at once. You're sitting there with different speakers and different screens going at once. So given that, and given the reality, what do you think maybe flew under the radar? What are some bills that you kind of heard about and you think maybe down the road you're going to be doing stories because they really were a big deal, but just something that was even a bigger deal was news that day?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of them. In fact, there's a lot, I mean, including the one I was just asked about and I drew a blank on, that will need some additional follow-up. And even this big rescue package that was passed and signed into law by the governor yesterday, there is going to be a lot of account of it. It's on reporters' backs up here to follow that money, where it goes, how it was spent, because there's a lot of pilot programs, as House Speaker Fecteau pointed out, that, you know, may not be fully developed. And these are issues that, you know, as reporters, we need to make sure that that money's being spent wisely, that it did what it was intended to do. So I think starting right there is a good spot to, you know, go back and look and at what, you know, certain things that flew under the radar, you know, a provision in a 90 or an 80 page bill, you know, that designates a couple million dollars may not sound like a lot, but, you know, that's public money and we should trace that and find out whether it was well used or not. So there's a lot of that that happened this year and we're still catching up. I mean, I have a list on my desk of all kinds of initiatives that passed and I'm not sure of even the status of some of them because some of these bills were carried over until next year. So their fate has not yet been determined yet.
And very briefly, Representative Dillingham was talking about property tax relief. At the same time, places like Portland and South Portland going through really painful revaluations for some people. When will the reality set in for property tax owners? When will they know how much relief what's happened from the state will provide their towns?
Well, some of it will depend on when they pass their budgets, the municipalities, right? So it depends on their budget year and how they go, whether it's a calendar year or a fiscal year. But I know that lawmakers were really eager to get a lot of that property tax relief done early for the towns that are setting their budgets or were setting their budgets back in June. And so some of those towns will see some relief then, but some of it may not come until next year. And, you know, a lot of it's through municipal revenue sharing. Some of it's from direct property relief, direct to the property taxpayer. And I think Democrats and Republicans and the governor in particular was very keen on having more of that targeted relief go right to the property taxpayer.
Well, thank you so much, Steve Missler, Maine Public's chief politics and government correspondent. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, medical experts return to answer questions about vaccination, immunity, masks, the Delta virus variant, and more. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.